Hello, and welcome to Cult Picks Radio, WCPX 66.6 on your pod dial, and your one-stop trusted source on everything you wanted to know about culty and sexy films, but were afraid to ask. With, as always, me, your host, Django Nudo.
And the Smut Peddler.
Now, this is our 12th episode, and we are super thrilled and thankful to all of you who have been downloading, listening, writing into us, and enjoyed it. We really appreciate it, and we've really enjoyed having this opportunity to talk about some of our favorite films that we are sharing on Cult Picks, and that we hope you enjoy as well. So, having done 12 episodes, we are going to take a little summer break in the grand Swedish tradition. So, this 12th episode marks the end of season one, but fear not, we will be back in late summer, early autumn with a second season of all new and improved, no doubt by then, Cult Picks Radio. However, before we call it end for the summer and head for the hammock and the beach, we wanted to give you a little special treat. And it is no secret that we have films on Cult Picks from a number of great companies that have partnered and worked with us. But there is one company that holds a very special place in our twisted little black hearts. And thus, it is our great privilege to present to you and share the insights from really the person who embodies that company now. So if you are not familiar with Something Weird Video, and you really should be, and this is your chance to do that, then we wanted to start off by first of all giving you a little audio tease and trailer and introduction to the weird, the wonderful, and the wacky world that is Something Weird Video.
Are you kids?
Oh, please. Use my body to keep you alive.
Drugs. Often the introduction comes in the form of a goofball.
Paula, I may be a bitch, but I'll never be a butch.
Welcome to Cult Picks Radio, to one of the oldest friends of Cult Picks, or as it was before, Club Super 8, Lisa Petrucci from Something Weird Video. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. I haven't talked to you, well, to Rickard in quite a while, so I'm excited about this.
And this is the first time that I meet you, to my great shame, but you know, it's still a great occasion that we finally get to know each other this way, so better late than
ever. Pleasure meeting you.
Likewise. Now, shame on anybody who hasn't heard of Something Weird Video, because you are, you know, the, I'm not going to go off on a, you know,
going on too much about just how amazing you are, but you know, because we don't want to make other people jealous. Oh, but please. Something Weird Video is something special. And but before we get into Something Weird Video, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came into this wonderful, weird, wacky world of genre film?
Well, ever since I was a little kid, I actually had been watching horror movies and stuff at the drive-in and on television. So I got a pretty early start. I mean, I guess my cherry got popped with Night of the Living Dead when I was 7 years old. So that explains a lot. Yeah, I was supposed to be sleeping in the back seat of the car when my parents were at the drive-in, but no, I was watching and I was terrified for the rest of my life. So, but anyway, I would watch a lot of UHF television, and there was a lot of like monster movies and kind of oddball things there. And then in the early 80s on basic cable, a lot of exploitation films started popping up on there. So that was kind of where I learned about genre film and started renting videos, things like Basket Case and Pink Flamingos and, you know, a lot of the big box VHSs that had come out in the early 80s. So that was kind of my primer. But eventually, I kind of dove in deep when I moved to New York City, and I lived a block from Kim's Video and went down the rabbit hole from that point. So started watching everything. And that was probably late 80s at that point. So, and I did notice on the walls at Kim's Video, there were these really garishly colored VHS tapes. And of course, I was attracted to them immediately. And they had titles like The Sin Syndicate and Bad Girls Go to Hell. And I'm like, well, I got to watch those. And that was my introduction to Something Weird. So here I am, you know, 30 years later.
And did you come from a very movie-obsessed family, or, you know, was it sort of a big thing for you growing up, or just something everybody did, going to the drive-in? And
Yeah, well, here in the States, I think that, you know, if you grew up in the 1960s, early 1970s, that was something we did. And I would say that, like, you know, my family wasn't way into movies, but my mother would go to the drive-in usually a couple times a month and drag me along. So I saw like all kinds of different things, you know, mostly inappropriate for a little kid, but nonetheless, I got to see them and they made a huge impression on me.
And what was it that sort of took you to New York? Were you studying, living, you know, met somebody?
Well, that's quite an interesting story, because the way I even got into film history and just genre film appreciation was I went to art school in Boston area during the early 1980s. And, you know, I was actually doing some film programming at the time when I was at the colleges. So I'd rent, you know, 60 millimeter films of like Faster Pussycat Kill Kill and other films and show them to other needy students who were unfamiliar with this stuff. And so I mostly had an art background because I was making art, and I also started working in art galleries when I graduated from college. So, but I always, at the same time, still had an interest in film and watching movies. But what happened is by the late 1980s, I was getting pretty jaded on the art scene in New York City. And I should say before that, I moved from Boston to New York around 1988. And I was working at some galleries at the time. And I just found myself just getting more and more interested in popular culture and things unrelated to, like, let's say the high art world. I was definitely more interested in low art and, you know, the whole lowbrow art movement and anything that that pertained to, which usually meant like a lot, I don't know, a lot of subjects from the mid-century time period, whether it be films or books or art or whatever. So I started writing about popular culture at that time while I was still working in art galleries.
And so, Lisa, you are also an artist in your own right. I don't know if everyone knows that.
Yeah, that was my other hat for many, many years. Before I started working at Something Weird, I was exhibiting my art all over the place. I was fortunate enough to like be in on the lowbrow art movement pretty early on, and also being like one of the few women in the like late 1980s and early 1990s that was doing that kind of art. Now everybody's doing it. It's just like, you know, very familiar to people, and it's almost as if like people don't realize that there wasn't an audience for that kind of art up until like the mid 1990s. So I was kind of doing it in a vacuum and just for myself for many years. And then I discovered that the West Coast was the place to show that kind of art. So I started exhibiting there. My first show was at La Luz de Jesus Gallery. And kind of people liked what I was doing. I mean, I guess I could describe it as all of my interests thrown into like a visual format. Like I'm a collector of stuff. So I collect dolls. So I started putting in like little Kittle influenced characters in my art and like lots of Day-Glo colors from the 1960s. So they kind of look like kids books from, you know, that time period. And I don't know. It also like there's a few film references and stuff in my art during that time as well. So yeah, it was definitely like a career that I had, and it was something I did for over 20 years, but eventually something weird took over my life. So now it's like 100% that, and I've kind of retired from painting and I'm resting on my laurels.
And when you say something weird took over your life, it's in capital letters. It was something weird.
Definitely. Yeah.
So before we get into something weird, and I want to explore that one in detail as well. Were there any of the Something Weird videos that you had seen, or sorry, films that you had seen or you were aware of kind of prior to your encounter with Something Weird itself? And
well, probably like a lot of the public domain movies that everybody had out at the time, Something Weird was also putting those out. But I mean, as far as like what Something Weird came to be known as, my first exposure was those VHS tapes and, you know, seeing the Michael and Roberta Findlay movies and the Doris Wishman movies on VHS was like a huge life changer for me.
Well, before we get into Something Weird, let's have you pick your first, as we're saying, the UK Desert Island Disc, which is your first film that you'd like to, you know, give a shout out to and tell us a little bit about from the wonderful Something Weird collection.
Wow, that's a tough one. I mean, because if people say, what's your top 10 list? And I was like,
yeah, pick your favorite kids.
Yeah, exactly. Which one do you like the best? I'm going to just say, and it's funny because it's like the one that's probably the most family friendly, Monsters Crash the Pajama Party Spook Show Spectacular. That is the greatest thing we ever made. Hands down.
Yeah. So yeah, tell people, actually, why don't we begin by playing a clip from it, and then you can tell us a little bit about it. So here's a clip from Monsters Crash the Pajama Party Spooktacular.
It's so scary, we dare you to see The Monsters Crash the Pajama Party, the first movie ever filmed in Hollywood's latest miracle, fantastic horror vision. You'll be petrified as fiendish movie monsters actually become alive, then crash right out of the screen, run into the audience, and carry screaming girls from their seats right back into the picture to become part of the movie, never to be seen alive again.
So hard to visualize maybe a little bit what's going on here, but this wasn't just any ordinary type of monster movie, was it?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, there was a phenomenon happening in the United States called spook shows, and they started in the earlier part of the century as mostly just like stage shows with magicians and like gimmicky type things. And by the 1950s, they were showing like monster movies with like almost like horror hosts introducing the films and still doing magic tricks, but all kinds of goofy gimmicks and things that like audiences ate up. You know, they basically have like, our mentor, Dave Freeman, would say, selling the sizzle and not the steak, you know, so they'd have these amazing promos for these films or like different spook shows that looked like they were going to be like the most thrilling, horrific thing you ever saw. And it ended up like when you went there, it was just some corny like magician showing like, you know, Bride of Frankenstein, and then in between like having some fake ghosts flying overhead and some people dressed up in monster costumes and stuff. But it was a whole experiential thing. And they went on until like the early 1970s, you know, full throttle. And then, you know, there was still vestiges of it in the 80s, but definitely during the 50s and 60s, they were a thing here in the States that lucky kids got to see. I didn't. I was too young.
But we can capture it now on seeing it on tape and get a bit of flavor for it. So with that, I want to now get on to the history of Something Weird Video and prior to you encountering it, Lisa. So can you tell us a little bit about the kind of origins?
Well, Something Weird Video was founded by Mike Rainey, my husband and business partner and love of my life. In the late 1980s, he was a bootlegger back then. So him and everybody else who just discovered what a VCR was recording things off of television and then selling them in fanzines or on lists. And, you know, it was a wild west, as we would say, for the home video market. And it was around 1990 that Mike started actually collecting film elements. Some of the first ones were like 8mm and 16mm girly loops that were shown in arcade machines. And he realized that there really wasn't any of that on home video. So he went and had them transferred locally, and it was pretty bad as far as the quality back then.
Where was he based and where was he finding these gems?
Well, he was here in Seattle. Mike is originally from the Pacific Northwest. I should also say that Mike had a whole career before he started Something Weird Video. He managed punk rock bands during the early 1980s and up until about 85, 86. He managed Ed Kennedy's and TSOL and a local band called The Accused. And he was quite the promoter. So as Rickard can tell you, so he started doing that for many, many years. And then he got married and had some kids and realized that he probably had to get a real job. So and being him, he was never going to work for anybody and figured out a way to keep making money. So the video dubbing worked out really, really well for him. So he started a little mail order company, and he had some rental videos in shops around Seattle and stuff. But like I said, it wasn't until like about 1990 that he got into film himself and wasn't just like taking pre-existing things and bootlegging them. We also started getting more feature films, like some sexploitation things, like I said before, The Sin Syndicate, and just any number of like films that he was able to find locally. And fortunately, there had been some adult theaters in the Seattle area, and there were films laying around in either depots or storage spaces, and he started tracking those down. And then, the funny thing was, the first time he put those out on home video, he was screening them at a porno theater called the Apple Theater here in Seattle, and he'd like have a video camera, and he'd just be recording them off the screen. And it was hilarious because people would be walking by and you see like a head, a shadow, or this or that. And I mean, it was like completely amateur hour there, but for the most part, people got to see these movies for the first time, and that excited them. So, and then he realized, wow, there's got to be more of this stuff out there. So he started, kind of searching through Big Reel magazine and word of mouth, just, hey, you got any of these dirty movies from like the 1960s? And, people started to surface. And it really wasn't until he, he was still a pirate in a lot of ways, but he took some VHSs of David F. Friedman's movies and put them out and got a phone call one day. Mm-hmm. And old man goes, hey, kid, what are you doing? Those are my movies. And Mike's like, yeah, people love them. And he's like, well, he totally glossed over he was doing anything wrong or anything. So he said to Friedman, you got any more? He goes, we should meet up. So, that month they got together and hit it off. And Dave took him to his film vault on Cordova Street in Los Angeles and said, well, what do you think you want? And Mike's like, I want it all. And he said, well, let's just start with a few. And, Mike had taken out Space Thing and Smell of Honey, Swallow Brine, and quite a few of the real classic Friedman titles. And we'll see how these do. And when Dave got his first royalty check, he was just so blown away. He goes, kid, you can have everything. So that was the beginning of, our relationship with Dave Friedman. And I would say that was probably the pivotal moment for making Something Weird Video a legitimate company, like having that kind of, you know, credibility working with him. And then at the same time, Dave was introducing us to, well, I keep saying us, I wasn't even around back then. Mike's been gone for 7.5 years. I still say us. It's crazy. And it ended up that, you know, Dave introduced Mike to all his cronies. And from there, he was able to get like the libraries of Harry Novak and Joe Sarno and some other film distributors, you know, from both Los Angeles and New York City. So it was, a really exciting time in those first, like, say, 5 years in the 90s, you know, of just kind of like, you know, a treasure hunt where you didn't really know what you were going to find when you'd go to a film archive. You know, a lot of people were just letting him in and saying, go for it, you know, take whatever you want. So the rest is history.
It feels like even though he was technically a pirate because he didn't own the rights when he was in those early days sort of promoting the films, he was driven by genuine passion for the film, and you know, that's, he was creating a new audience for them, which, you know, hadn't appreciated them, and it must have been that which, you know, was what made it such a fortuitous meeting of minds between him and Dave Friedman.
Oh, absolutely. And the thing too is that, you know, he had like a certain vision, and, you know, it wasn't like he was just putting out anything and everything. It's like, he knew what he was looking for. And, you know, I always hate to use the word curated, but it's true. I mean, he started like a curated catalog and collection of films that have come to be known as like Something Weird titles, even though, you know, we didn't make a single one of these movies, but they're associated with Something Weird because he brought them to people's attention.
Now, if you had to, because we have to get to the selections. Well, if you had to pick out a David Friedman film, which one would it be?
I would say She Freak.
Excellent choice.
I love that movie.
Let's do a little clip from She Freak.
There are only two kinds of freaks, ladies and gentlemen. Those created by God and those made by man. The creature in this pit is a living, breathing human being that once was. That's another story that happened a long time ago, a long way from here. Look, if you must.
That was She Freak, and that was not just by David Friedman, it's with David Friedman as well, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, he makes a big cameo. Definitely has a supporting actor role in it. And I mean, that was Dave's probably favorite film, and his, you know, love letter to circuses and carnivals and freak shows, and something that he had been involved with from the time he was a kid. So I would say out of all of his movies, that's the most personal one, and probably the most popular too, because, you know, it's seedy, but it doesn't have like a lot of, you know, sex in it or nudity. You know, anybody can watch that movie. In fact, there was a funny story about it that I guess that AIP had shown an interest, and they told him, like, you know, we know what your other movies are like, so like if you could make this one a little bit tamer, we might want to distribute it. And when Dave was like, you know, second guessing like what he should and shouldn't have in it, and when the final cut came out, they go, why wasn't there more blood, or why wasn't there more this? Because, I mean, people were comparing it to like Blood Feast or some of his other more racy movies.
And it's obviously got a great pedigree in terms of inspiration from Todd Browning's Freaks, but it does so much more than just sort of knock it off or update it. I mean, it really is a love letter to the whole world of circus, carnivals, freak shows.
Oh, absolutely. And I was going to say, you know, he had seen Freaks when he was a kid, and it was obviously his favorite movie. And he had read Nightmare Alley and all of those influences. Like, I guess his dad was even like a member of the Circus Association of America when he was growing up. So, I mean, he had it in his blood, and he was a carny, like, out of the womb.
Which is great if you're going to be a filmmaker, and especially if you're going to be a kind of exploitation or genre filmmaker. Now, we've talked about Something Weird in the plural, but what were your first kind of steps with Something Weird, and when did it become really a family matter?
Well, I met Mike in 1993 at a horror convention called Chiller Theater that they had twice a year in New Jersey. I was living in New York City at the time, and I was writing for a number of magazines, mostly about just pop culture in general, but trying to focus on genre film and especially sexploitation cinema, which nobody really wanted to like publish anything about. But I'm like, well, I got to find an angle that, you know, is acceptable to the, you know, the unwashed masses. And also, you know, something that I was really, really into. So, of course, I wanted to, you know, pursue that more. So Dave Friedman was Mike's guest at the table. So I, you know, I'd met him and had him sign my book copy of A Youth in Babylon. And I was super excited about that. And then I met Mike and he just kind of looked at me with, you know, goo-goo eyes. And he was like, oh, you like these movies? I was like, oh, yeah. You know, and, you know, the Findlays and Doris Wishman are two of my favorites. And he just said, oh my God, that's so cool. Cause I guess he hadn't really met too many women who were interested in that kind of stuff. So anyway, we struck up a friendship at first and I did the interview with him and, you know, and Dave as well. And I wrote an article about Something Weird and kind of just like a primer about like, you know, the sexploitation aspect of their business. And Mike and I stayed in touch for a while and he would send me whatever new releases came out, which was great because I didn't have to rent them anymore and I got to have them and it was awesome. In fact, some of them weren't even like legitimately out yet. Like he would send me just a dub with a handwritten note on it, which, you know, I keep those tapes. They're really special to me. And I saw him at the next Chiller Theater convention and he's just like, I can't stop thinking about you. And I was like, well, it's a little, your life's a little complicated. And I live here in New York and, you know, let's just see what happens, you know. And I was actually planning on moving to Los Angeles at the time because I was getting more and more into my own art career and nothing was happening in New York City. There just wasn't in a gallery or an audience for that kind of work. So I moved to Los Angeles in 1994, right before the Northridge earthquake. And Mike was doing a lot of business there at the time, so we were seeing each other quite a bit. And by this time, you know, we were in love. It wasn't just, you know, professional relationship. I mean, we had a personal bond there as well. And the Northridge quake happened, and I was just like, I don't know if I want to live here. And he said, well, I think it's time for you to move to Seattle. And both had to make some major life changes to have that happen. But by mid-94, I was in Seattle, and mostly at that time, just helping him with research and writing some descriptions for films and stuff. But by 1995, because I was, you know, had an art background and whatnot, and I was graphic designer before I was a painter, I started working on the catalogs and, you know, video box cover designs. And that became my job for, you know, 15 years before I got more responsibilities dumped on me. So yeah, that was kind of my introduction to working at Something Weird, being on the staff.
And overlapping work and personal relationship, did that make things easier? You know, did it get too much sometimes, or you know, a bit of both depending on the day?
Well, for the most part, we were always on the same page. I mean, that was one of the wonderful things about our relationship, was that, you know, we're kind of symbiotic that way. So wasn't too, I mean, I pretty much, I could like second guess what he wanted all the time. So, I mean, if I designed something, I kind of knew what direction he wanted things to go. So, I would say mostly it was great. I mean, we rarely had any like disagreements or like, you know, different ideas about things. So, which was great. I mean, most people can't say that about their relationships. I mean, people will say, well, you know, you must have fought sometimes. It's like, yeah, over dumb stuff, you know, like raising kids or whatever. But for them, you know, everything else, I mean, we were soulmates. It was a pretty awesome time in my life.
And what was it like in the Pacific Northwest, Seattle at that time, sort of in general, just having moved there from, you know, having first lived in New York and then in L.A.?
I'm from Boston originally, so it was like Boston, New York, Los Angeles, and then Seattle, which was like going to Mars for me because people here were so different. It was just different attitudes. And I really liked, you know, I didn't really know anybody out here except, you know, him and people working at Something Weird. So it took a while to adapt. And, you know, when people would ask me, oh, where are you from? Even like 10, 15 years later, I'd be like, I'm from the East Coast. I was like, now I'm from Seattle. I've been here for almost 30 years. So I better be from here now. But it was just a period of adjustment. But in some ways, I mean, the quality of my life improved considerably. I mean, after living in New York, you know, and living hand to mouth. And I should also mention, when I lived in New York, I worked at the psychotronic store for about 6 months with Michael Weldon. And because he had the shop about two blocks from where I lived. So that was also another introduction I had to Something Weird Video. But yeah, I mean, now that I'm here in Seattle, I can't imagine living anywhere else.
So quite the culture shock going to Seattle after all those cities before. But before we get on to even more of a culture shock, which is going to Sweden, why don't you tell us about the next film out of the great SWV lineup that you have selected for us?
Well, we'll keep with the letter S. And another I should say, too, I'm very, you know, much in love with all of our female-centric films. So I'm going to say Shanty Tramp.
Yay.
And so that one is also a problematic film for many people just because of, you know, the time period it was done. There's some pretty, like, you know, hard to watch scenes now, especially given the, you know, the racial climate nowadays. But I always look at these films as time capsules. And, you know, we've talked about censorship and whatnot in the past. It's like, I would just rather be able to, like, see these films. I don't have to agree with everything that's happening in them, but they're fascinating in and of themselves because of, like, them capturing a moment in time.
Time capsules, exactly. Well, let's hear a clip from Shanty Tramp. Before we get on to Sweden Club Super 8 and how you met the smut peddler, picking up on the point of censorship and context and trigger warnings and all of that, has there been, or for Something Weird Video, have you received blowback at times? I mean, obviously, these films aren't everybody's cup of tea, but, you know, for people who are into them, and especially the current climate, has there been a change, or is there a kind of acceptance of these films are of their period?
Well, it's a little bit of both. For theatrical screenings here in the States, it's become a lot more challenging because you almost have to, like, you know, think ahead of time, like, is there going to be anything in this movie that's going to offend somebody? And of course there is, because that was, like, you know, the whole premise of Something Weird Video was to be as abrasive as possible. So I'll usually, like, you know, think in the back of my mind, like, all right, what's going to be an issue or problem or whatever, and try to remember what those things are and give a trigger warning at the beginning, because when I haven't done that, I've gotten a lot of, like, blowback and just people just enraged about, like, how, you know, aren't you reading the room? Like, this is inappropriate or this or that. And my attitude is, if you're going to see an exploitation film, you should know what you're getting yourself into. You know, it's like, don't have to pull any punches. It's like, the reason they are exploitation films is because they're exploiting something. You know, they're not meant to be sugarcoated at all. So, but even with like home video, I've noticed that like with Blu-rays coming out nowadays, some of the labels are like saying, well, you know, maybe we're not going to release this movie because, you know, it has some, you know, things that people that don't fly with some audiences. And instead of like, you know, having to, I don't know, make excuses or apologize for what you're showing, they just don't even want to release them, which doesn't seem right to me. I mean, I'm really pleased that companies like Severin Films and Mondo Macabro and Arrow Films are still pushing the envelope with a lot of the Euro stuff that they're doing. Because, you know, with a lot of American films and American companies, they're realizing that, okay, well, you know, we can't put out, you know, Olga's House of Shame, maybe, or, you know, something that's completely like, I don't know, just beyond abrasive. But I, in my attitude, I just want to keep, you know, pushing the envelope. And that was what Mike would have wanted. And I just keep doing what I'm going to do. And hopefully the partners that I work with agree with that. And it's wonderful working with you guys because, you know, you get it. And, you know, you're not sitting there like overthinking things at all. It's just like, yeah, these movies, you know, have merit in and of themselves. And, you know, they belong to each other, you know, like they're put in a context that way. So, you know, we have done some theatrical screenings in the last few years where, like, I mean, the internet blew up about how inappropriate the films were for the time. And I've literally had to go on and defend them. And I will do that all day long because I don't believe in, like, you know, taking something away because it's problematic, for lack of a better word.
It's a good segue now into, you know, the what used to be at least a very free-thinking country, Sweden, and how it is that you came to go there and how it is that you met the smut peddler, a.k.a. Rickard.
Well, I think Rickard should say how he met Mike. Tell us about that, because he and Mike were in touch before I was brought into the situation. So, Rickard?
Yeah.
Say how you got in touch.
I've been thinking about it, trying to think back. And I mean, we're going back now 21, 22 years, something like that.
And we're getting old and our memories are failing us.
Yeah, I guess. But I do remember that the person who put us in touch with each other was Stefan Kieri at the record company Subliminal Sounds. And how got in touch with Mike, I don't know. I do remember that.
I think he was a customer.
Yeah, that's right. He was a customer. And to my knowledge, Mike had basically not traveled outside of the U.S. apart from going to Brazil to meet Coffin Joe.
That's right. Yes, we were invited to do a film festival in Rio, and Roger Corman was the other American guest, so that was pretty cool. But I should also tell you guys, this is so funny. Like, the reason Mike didn't travel was because he was like a huge pothead. That was one of the, I mean, like, he was the most highly functioning pot smoker I've ever known in my life. I mean, it was like, it was basically his lifeblood. And he knew that if he went to other countries, like, he might not be able to get weed. So, and also the fact that he's like a rah-rah American kind of person, you know, and why would he want to go to other countries? Like, there's nothing there for him. And it's like, sure there is. You just haven't gone. You know, when you go there, you're going to be pretty, you know, excited about the things you get to do.
Mike was rather particular about his food, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. You guys know all about that. having to host us for two different film festivals. And between him and Friedman on the second one, it was hilarious. They found a place called the American Steakhouse, and I think they ate there most of their meals.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that what happened was we got in touch. We had an idea that Club Super 8, which at that time was just a film club, and we had barely started our you know, our movement. But we had the idea to bring you guys over, and we didn't have computers the way we have now. We didn't have the internet, so I still keep some copies of the letters we sent back and forth. And I do remember, and you have to, you know, tell me if I'm wrong here, but I do remember that you and Mike thought that we were some kind of jokers and we would never, ever send any airline tickets to you.
Well, we didn't, I mean, other than, you know, doing the festival in Rio, and that still blew our mind that, like, somebody paid for us to come out here and show Santa Claus Conquers the Martians or, you know, any of these other stupid movies that we showed, which were, you know, accepted with, like, you know, like rave reviews when we were down there. I think that, I mean, it was good that he had that positive experience going there, because otherwise I don't think he would have gone. But I was like, hey, you know, they're offering us a free trip to Sweden, and like, this would be super fun, and, you know, we'll just see how it goes. And I don't know, he just had so many like hesitations about leaving the country for anything. Once he was there and he met you guys, I mean, he knew he was amongst his people, so he was in a very happy place. I mean, it was probably the only place he would keep going to if he had still been around. It was Sweden. We would continue to visit you forever till we all dropped dead.
I do believe that we are and were kindred spirits and sort of brother from another mother, and we really
absolutely
hit it off.
Yeah,
but also, I do remember that, because we did actually, I don't know how we even got the guts, we did two major Scandinavian tours with you guys, and the second one with Dave Friedman. But I also remember that Mike could be a super demanding guy, because if something didn't work out, it should. He could call me up and just tell me off in a very...
Oh, he was awful. I mean, that's one of the reasons. I mean, like, I was so happy that you guys, you know, you understood that about him, because he had a real scorched earth policy with a lot of people, you know. It's like, if it was his way or the highway. And
but I would say that he was often right. If we didn't do it professionally, and he felt that you know, I wasn't up to par, he would tell me that, and I would have to, you know, get my shit together.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
No, I think it was prudent. I don't think it was a problem at all. But I do remember the one time that he told a reporter off, that a guy who had said that he would support our festival, and it didn't do jack shit for us. I've never seen anyone be so destroyed by another person.
Oh, yeah, no, he didn't pull any punches, that's for sure. No. And he said exactly what was on his mind at any given time. And fortunately, he was charming enough that he could get away with it. Most people couldn't.
I mean, those two festivals are the some of the fondest memories in my life, for sure.
Oh, us too. I mean, all I have to do is look at photos from, you know, because I took a ton of photos when we were there. And I even, like, wrote a travelogue for Cult Movies Magazine at one point about our trip. I think it was, I don't know if it was the first one or the second one, but... I loved going to Scandinavia, and you guys were the best hosts. And I mean, we made lifelong friends. Yeah. And you can't say that about everything. There's certain times when, you know, you work with other colleagues or you do other stuff, and it's a like a burden, and you're like, oh God, I just want this to be over. And I didn't want to go home. I had such
That's a great time. Oh, and I got some emails over the last couple of weeks from a guy called Christian Svensson, who was one of the most avid fans of the Something Weird festivals. And he kept everything. He saved everything. And he still has some t-shirts with Mike's signature on them. He got him to sign all these kinds of stuff, and he still has it around.
Scandinavian superfan.
Very much so.
How did the relationship evolve then from a kind of meeting of minds and kindred spirits into a kind of business and professional relationship? Because again, Club Super 8 and Something Weird Video go back years and years and years before Cult Pics.
Well, I think, in, you know, with Rickard hooking us up with, you know, prints of films that, you know, you guys were finding in Scandinavia, as well as, you know, we did some releases together, like, you know, Terror in the Midnight Sun, Invasion of the Animal People.
Actually, I think that was where it started, that you wanted us to get in touch with the producer of that film.
Yeah. And we ended up releasing that on an Image Entertainment special edition DVD with commentary from him. And I can't remember what extras were on there, but it was probably some great stuff. So.
Yeah, well, there were the Sami women biting the nuts off the reindeer.
Yes. Well, from Ek. And what I'll always remember about going to Scandinavia was you guys had found that print of The Pickup.
Oh, yeah.
With the Danish subtitles, and Dave Friedman had not seen that film like since it was released in the 1960s. And sitting next to him in the theater and his love scene came up, and we're all just all like guffawing. it was kind of uncomfortable, but you know, we never really see Dave in a love scene before. But he's like, "Yeah, that's me up there," you know. And I said, "Well, did Carol ever get to see that film?" And he's like, "Oh no." So that was his wife's name. But yeah, that was really memorable, sitting in a dark theater with maybe a dozen of us watching that for like probably the first time it had been seen in, you know, 40 years.
Yeah, and I also remember, Dave, when he was in Stockholm, that we somehow managed to get this Hotel Lydmar to sponsor your stay. And I think they probably got their money back off Dave's drinking gin in the bar.
Oh, yeah. And I have to say, when you did anything with Friedman, it revolved around drinking and eating. We had many a meal with him at Musso and Frank in Los Angeles over the years. That was his favorite place to go. He had been going there since the 1960s. He knew all the maitre d's and bartenders, and they treated him like royalty anytime we went. So, but yeah, I mean, we always knew if we were taking Dave to a convention or a film festival or whatever, it was going to revolve around eating and drinking.
And he was a happy camper then.
Oh, absolutely. He loved it. He had a great time.
And also, I remember Dave was a real trooper, because I think he had to get up in the middle of the night to introduce a film like at 1 o'clock in the morning. He had no problem with that in Helsinki, right?
Oh, no, not. Dave could like outdo us as far as his energy level went. I mean, he was always ready to like perform and be on. So
there's never a good time to stop the reminiscing and discussion, but I do want to get another film in. So let's have another pick from the Something Weird jukebox to give people a flavor.
So, speaking of jukebox, I guess I'll say Psychedelic Sex Kicks and Wild Hippie Party is one of my favorite movies. That was probably one of the last things that we released on DVD. Before Mike got sick, and it was a lost like psychedelic sexploitation film that was filmed in San Francisco from the late 1960s, and it had like an amazing like spoken word and sitar soundtrack, and then hippies smoking weed and getting naked and lots of just, you know, psychedelic wonderfulness, and it ended up that I released a soundtrack for that movie with one of my partners, Modern Harmonic. And what they did was take little sound bites and some of the, sitar audio and make an LP out of it, which, you know, they probably never thought that would happen when that film was made. It was very, very low budget.
Let's hear a clip from the music from Psychedelic Sex Kicks, double bill with Wild Hippie Party. A great favorite of ours too, because we recently did the drugsploitation theme week. In fact, two theme weeks. There were so many great films that we couldn't fit them all into one theme week. But this was definitely one of the highlights. And the poster for Psychedelic Sex Kicks was also our choice for poster of the week. It's just magnificent. It's really got everything. I mean, it might have been done.
Yeah, all of that gorgeous day glow color and like, you know, the kind of primitive artwork and that, you know, kind of psychedelic lettering.
Yeah, yeah, the lettering and, you know, and everything perfect. That it promises. Yeah, yeah. It looks good on anybody's wall. So, you know, we should do a limited edition reprint, re-release of it to go with it. But
well, if people get the LP, it's pretty much like a square version of the poster. So hang that on your wall in the meantime.
Frame the LP. So, unfortunately, Mike isn't with us anymore, and it must have been a sort of difficult time to see a loved one suffer, and at the same time having the responsibility and having, you know, the business to take care of. How did you cope during that time?
Well, in 2012, Mike had been having some health issues, and I should also say that Mike had smoked his entire life. I mean, I think from the time he was 13 years old, he had a cigarette in his mouth, you know, at least at once an hour. And he had actually quit smoking about a year before. He was just vaping at that point, which is probably not good for you either. But he just started to have some respiratory issues. And, you know, we went to the doctors and they did a chest X-ray and they found like a large tumor in his lungs. And they said, well, you've got stage 4 cancer. And, you know, nobody expected to hear that. And told us that he had about a year and a half to 2 years to live. And, you know, he didn't, I mean, the thing about it is he never believed any of that. He's like, oh, I'm going to be fine. I'm going to like beat this. And, you know, and I wanted him to have that attitude because, you know, that was going to help him get through all of this. And, he went through chemotherapy and radiation and, didn't really have much time in between like that and getting to the point where, you know, that the cancer had taken over and metastasized. So, it was really, you know, it was difficult for all of us. I mean, obviously he was my soulmate and to see him going through that and the fact that, you know, like having a time limit really made it, I don't know, just it kind of made it more real and urgent to be able to spend quality time together and all that kind of stuff. So we, you know, we had to talk about what was going to be the future of the company. And I know people aren't going to want to hear this, but about a year or two before that, you know, he was diagnosed. It was probably like, well, I should say 2011, Dave Friedman died. And he was old. Of course, he was going to pass away. He was on Valentine's Day. And Mike just decided at that point, after like you're releasing another bunch of movies on home video, you know, we did one of our catalog supplements. It was catalog supplement number 27. There was such a lackluster response. And the home video market at that time had just really, you know, diminished. We decided, well, we need to maybe think about like what the future is going to hold for us. And he said, this isn't fun anymore. He said, especially now that Dave's not here. He goes, all of my old guys are gone. He goes, you know, the treasure, you know, hunting and all of that stuff, that was the fun part for him. And getting to like know the people that were involved in this stuff, you know, back in the old days. And you know, we were starting to see more companies, I don't want to say copying something weird, but you know, basically copying something weird. I'm just going to come out and say it. Because if I was a video company and I was starting up, I mean, I think it's a pretty good template to work off of. And I think he said, you know what, I think we're done. And he goes, I want to just start collecting again. And, you know, he was a picker. He's Mike all along, you know, even though he was head of a video company and did all this other stuff, he was still always buying collectibles and selling collectibles. And he goes, yeah, that's what I want us to do. And, you know, we also have this archive, like, I know that you want to publish books and do all this other stuff. He goes, you know, we're going to head in that direction. And that was before he got the diagnosis. And he said to me, you know, about 6 months before he passed away, he goes, I don't want you to continue this. He goes, it's just too much of a burden. And he goes, I don't expect you to. But what he didn't realize is that, you know, something weird is just as much me as it was him. And that man had an incredible legacy and it needed to be preserved and honored. So that's what I've done for the last 7.5 years. I mean, something weird isn't about me at all. I mean, I'm just kind of like, you know, the person that keeps it going. It's always been about Mike and will always be his vision. And I just keep it going.
But also, I think it's important to state that Mike's legacy still lives on because he's been the mentor of so many people, myself included, that, you know, I wouldn't be where I am right now without him, for sure. And also the fact that you now are working with Agfa and your films are released by, you know, a bunch of companies that you're also friends with and that are your partners and that can, you know, professionally release the films and get them out there. I mean, it's bigger than ever to me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad to hear that because, you know, I kind of had an idea in the back of my mind what I would have liked to see happen. And, you know, I didn't want to just do a mail order business for the rest of my life. I mean, because I'll tell you, that's daily drudgery. That part is not fun. I mean, the creative part of it is what has fueled me all these years. And but I had to figure out what was going to happen with the film archive. Mike had collected over 300 tons, and I'm not exaggerating, of film. And 16 millimeter, 35 millimeter negatives, prints. We had multiple buildings full of film. I had to figure out where those were going to go. And it was more important to me that they like be placed in the best homes possible. And that meant a lot of different places. Because I mean, Mike had told me it was just sell the company like to one person or whatever. And I'm like, well, it's not that easy because it's a pretty eclectic catalog. And, you know, somebody may not be interested in the, you know, XXX adult stuff or the public domain stuff or the sex, you know, like, and I realized that I was going to have to treat it as a pie. So I'm cutting up the pieces of the pie. And I was really, really fortunate that the first serious inquiry that I got was from Alamo Drafthouse. And Zach Carlson, who works with Joe Ziemba on Bleeding Skull, and he's also like a Pacific Northwest person that got transplanted to Austin. He contacted me. He goes, so what are you going to do with this film archive? And I said, well, I'm wondering that too. And so he said, well, you know, how do you feel about Tim League coming out and, you know, taking a look and assessing what you've got there and, you know, seeing if there's any possibilities there. So he came out and he was overwhelmed like everybody is first time they see the film archive. And he said, well, I have a proposal, like, what if we could cherry pick, like, you know, a number of a lot of titles and, you know, represent those. And, you know, AGFA would be like the ones who would be like storing the films and, you know, possibly doing something with them in the future. And I agreed to that. I said, that's a perfect idea. I really, really liked that idea. And they actually put me in touch with some other film archivists as well for a lot of the remaining collection. Which there still is remaining collection. I've got one, I'm down to one warehouse now. So anyway, once we started that ball rolling, I met the guys from AGFA, and I mean, I love them. I mean, everybody who works at AGFA are just the best people and really, really just wonderfully enthusiastic. And, you know, I feel like they're my younger brothers and sisters. They're just awesome. And we got the idea that, well, if we're going to like get these films and start doing restorations, like maybe we need a scanner. So they did a Kickstarter to, you know, say that something weird and AGFA, we're going to be working together. And in order to do that, we would, you know, need to fund a scanner. And it ended up working out really, really well. And they got their scanner and our first release was the Zodiac Killer. So that was the first of a number of partnerships. I've been working with Severn Films. They put out our That Sexploitation documentary and a number of the Mondo films that were in our archive. Been working with Alternative Cinema under their Pop Cinema moniker on some of the sexploitation titles, and Film Detectives doing some of the public domain titles. And this is just a lot of different. Oh, Kino Lorber, which is, you know, under their Kino Classics label. We're doing a lot of the Roadshow, you know, old exploitation movies. So I feel like things are where they belong. And, you know, I hope that Mike would be happy.
And I think it's so interesting that everything of this comes out of fandom. I mean, ourselves with Club Super 8 and Cult Picks in a smaller way, maybe 1/10 of you got what you guys have been doing, also come from fandom. But then we realize over time that we are actually film historians and we are preserving film history, and that was never meant to be, but it's certainly a perk.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what's so cool though is, like, I mean, to me it's neat. When we were first like researching these movies in the 90s, before the pre-internet, you know, the only information we could get was like either if we found one of the old dudes and they had the information, or press books and, you know, American Film Institute catalog and all of these, those types of things. And so we were kind of just like learning as we were doing it. And since then, like, there's so many genre film experts who've like found out way more than we ever have. And, you know, I know like it's embarrassing sometimes to go on our website because I don't have time to update that thing. Sorry. I got too many other things on my plate. Like eventually I need to just, you know, do a book that's going to be our catalog, but with all of the like updated information, because I mean, there's some really incredible scholars out there who've, you know, dug up stuff that we never knew.
This is a good time to have another movie pick, but after that, I want to get on to your own collecting and your own collection, because equally fascinating. So which film are you going to treat us to next?
Well, since I mentioned the old-timey roadshow movies, one of the probably the most popular one that we had is called Teaserama, which was a burlesque film that starred Betty Page and Tempest Storm. And we were able to get the negative for that film in the early 1990s from Dave Friedman, who had worked with Dan Sunny, whose father had Sunny Amusement Enterprises and was like an old roadshowman from way back. And we had a lot of controversy over that film in the 90s because we had featured Betty Page on the cover of the packaging, and it was right around the time that she had resurfaced, and there was like a very gung-ho lawyer at the time who was basically suing anybody who was using her likeness on stuff. And we ended up in a huge lawsuit with, you know, the representative of Betty Page. Come to find out, she didn't even know about any of this stuff. We won the case. It was actually like a major like court ruling that is now on the books and like the standard by which like all rights of publicity are based on because of this. I mean, $100,000 later and Hugh Hefner paying her off her legal bills, we came out okay. But in the meantime, it's a pretty amazing burlesque film because it's just so dazzling with the color, and it's got all of the like most popular dancers from the time period, and features Betty Page.
And some great music as well. Let's hear a clip from Teaserama. Now, we're talking about collecting, and obviously Mike was in a league of his own, if not, you know, completely different ball game. But you've hinted at this, you know, as an artist, as a, I know you hate the word curator, but you've been collecting things yourself, not talking about films and prints, but, you know, tell us a little bit about your collection and your collecting and how that's evolved over the years.
Well, one of the other things that brought Mike and I together was that we both were like such fanatical collectors of stuff. And I mean, he would even tell people like, Lisa's got a bigger, you know, vintage men's magazine collection than I do, or, you know, that kind of stuff. He was very proud of that. But we both collected like mostly pop culture from our childhood, but also film related things, and we're both monster kids. So love anything, you know, monster themed, especially from the mid 1960s. I collect circus and carnival stuff, and I ended up with all of Dave Friedman's museum, which, you know, I don't even have half of it displayed because there was just so much. I also collect dolls, and I collect what I call big eye art, like Margaret Keane paint, you know, pictures and prints and We collect all different kinds of stuff. It's like when people come to the house, it's like going to a museum. And I still have it. I mean, it's funny. There's some rooms in my house I don't even go in because they're just like the collection. Like the cats hang out in there. I don't hang out. So they get to look at all the cool stuff. But yeah, I mean, we both were, you know, big fans of going to swap meets and flea markets, and eBay was a, you know, a place where we got a lot of our collectibles in the 90s. And I mean, Mike had this, I don't know, I call it one of his superhero powers, where he was just able to like get stuff for practically nothing. You know, he'd go to, you know, the swap meet at 6 a.m. and come home with like a van full of like the craziest stuff that nobody else. I was like, only you could have like, you know, paid $100 for this van load of stuff. He just had a real, you know, knack for it. But now I'm still collecting paper and movie posters, a lot of that kind of stuff. And by the way, thank you, Rickard, for the Pippi Longstocking posters.
Oh, I know you love that.
I do love me some Pippi Longstocking. And books and records. And yeah, it's funny. I don't plan on selling any of our collection. I mean, at some point I probably should just like, you know, charge admission and let the neighbors come in and look at the stuff when I'm an old lady. But one of the things I'm going to be doing in the future with the collections is, I mean, obviously we amassed like tens of thousands of, you know, pieces of paper with, you know, either exploitation film history related or any kind of other kind of pop culture stuff. But I want to do some books about exploitation film by the decade. And we've got like amazing amounts of material to be able to do that. And that's pretty much what I plan on doing, you know, when I get to a point where I've got more time to be creative and work on my own projects that, you know, other than just like day-to-day stuff. This last year, we are starting to wind down our in-house DVD-R manufacturing for a number of reasons. Mostly, I don't want to do it anymore. But B, it's getting really difficult to get like raw supplies, you know, blank discs, because we have old duplicators. They don't want to use any more than an 8X DVD-R disc, and, you know, supplies, and just, I'll be honest, doing customer service is really hard. I mean, it's a funny story that Mike was never allowed to talk to customers because he'd get too frustrated and impatient with them and yell at them and tell them to go F off. Which, I mean, Rickard's been on the other end of that, so he knows what that can be like. Mm.
No, I don't think that Mike should be a shop clerk meeting customers. No,
he is not allowed to have, you know, any contact with the general public, except at conventions where, you know, all of the fans love to sit down and talk with him. So he was well behaved there.
Smart Peddler, any final thoughts, questions, comments from you?
No, I just have to still have to underline that Cult Picks as idea and execution would never have happened without Something Weird Video, and that goes for you, Lisa, and Mike, of course, both of you, because we would never have even gotten around to thinking of releasing old Swedish movies. And
no, but you guys have made your own imprint. I mean, you've been around since the 90s, and you know, I'm always talking about Club Super 8 and how great you guys are. And, you know, you are basically like, you know, the Scandinavian arm of Something Weird.
Yeah, for sure. And Mike often talked about the 40 Thieves. And I was so excited about that concept. Can you tell us a little bit about where that came from?
Well, back in the old-timey exploitation roadshow days, I mean, there were a bunch of guys who, they were crooks. I mean, come right down to it. I mean, they knew how to make a buck and, you know, take advantage of all the rubes and all that kind of stuff. And people like Dwayne Esper, Dan Sonny's dad, Louis Sonny, was one. I mean, they were all carnies, but they were in the film business. And it ended up that there were 40. I think there's 40 of them. I can't remember all 40 names. I'm not going to even try. But when Dave Friedman met Mike and he introduced him to Dan Sonny, they both said, well, you know, we're dubbing you the 41st thief, because Mike was one of them. And, you know, with his attitude and just the way he went about doing everything. And that was probably the best compliment he said he ever got in his whole life.
Yeah. Talk about knighthood.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess it would be funny to do like a contemporary 40 Thieves because they're out there. You know, you'd be one.
Yeah, I think we have a band of crooks that they're not as much crooks as they used to be, but like-minded people who realize that we have a lot of things in common, and I think that's what we're trying to get together now with Cult Pigs, a global community of 40 thieves, maybe 40,000 thieves at the end of the day.
Well, you're definitely on the right track, and I love the direction it's going in.
Thanks, Lisa. That means a lot.
Well, I think that's a great note to end it on. So thank you very much, Lisa Petrucci, not just for coming on Cult Pigs Radio, but really for everything that you've done for these kind of films through Something Weird and beyond. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Rickard and Patrick. I appreciate you having me on. And yeah, it's like talking to family. So it's pretty easy.